Okay, thanks. Glad the workshop's going well. I wish I could attend more of it. So I started off not with a quiz, but a little introduction by, similar to one that Joe Polchinski gave at a recent talk. The numbers over here, okay, this is all intended to discuss this general problem of trying to find the right or the most interesting vacua in the string theory landscape as we understand it now, and really inspired by current efforts to do this with computers, and just trying to get some idea of what is the type of problem we face. So some of these numbers are very familiar, like this inverse cosmological constant, and I'm going to read all these numbers as possible numbers of vacua that we might be interested in. So the number that would be required to explain it anthropically or by some sort of statistical mechanism by again assuming a uniform distribution of vacua and cosmological constants out to the Planck scale. And then this is a more optimistic version where the base point is set by some low scale of supersymmetry. Of course, the kind of numbers that we get out of calculations of real hand-waving estimates of numbers of vacuum string theory are much bigger than this. And this could, the real number could be much bigger, much smaller. This is really a guess at this point. It's the techniques that go into making those guesses which might survive for subsequent developments. This is kind of the small, a small version of the problem that you might seriously consider working on, where you just say, I just want to enumerate the Calabi-Yau's, which is perhaps millions, tens of millions, and all the different ways of putting bundles and brains into different string theories, and just see what kind of gauge groups and so forth you get. And then, again, not a very well-supported estimate, but this would be the type of number that you might expect for all of these choices. Okay, so now over here, this is the number of flops you would get if you ran the IBM Blue Gene computer at Lawrence Livermore for a year. And it might be adequate to explore this. Obviously, it takes more than one operation to explore the vacuum, so it's really reaching it, but at least it's not totally out of proportion. But of course, these other numbers are. And then this is the number of Planck times to the present date, more or less. This is the number of Planck times, to the first, millisecond of cosmology from the Big Bang. This is this famous estimate of the number of particles in the known universe. And so I'm going to start off the talk kind of addressing the question, well, suppose we had to search through lists of vacua that were this big, and we had a computer which maybe could do this many operations. Well, obviously, you're going to have to be very clever to do it, to say the least, but to what extent could you do it in principle? And then later in the talk, and this will give me a chance to describe a lot of computational complexity theory, which is a fascinating topic. So if you really knew the equations of string theory, which we dream of, it's not impossible that someday we'll achieve that dream, then you really just had to produce solutions to those equations and search through them. Then we were talking about a well-posed problem in this subject of computational complexity theory. How hard is it really to generate and search through the solutions to those equations? And we'll just take what we, these toy models that we use now to try to illustrate the nature of what might be the problem, and then ways that this might change from subsequent developments. So now these other numbers having to do with the universe, there'll be a second part of the talk which is speculative, isn't even the right word, just provocative, I guess, that says, well, I'm going to argue that it's very hard. You can already imagine. It must be very hard to find the right vacuum out of a set like this, and we'll make that more precise. But then if we find that it's hard for us, how did the universe do it? Well, even if each particle can explore a universe, that's far fewer than even this number. And of course, there's a standard answer to that question in this context, having to do with the quote anthropic principle. There are many different ways of stating it. And the kind of second part of the talk is inspired by various things, but in particular a work of a guy named Scott Aronson, who argues that there's a precise sense in which the multiverse, if you regard the multiverse as universes like the one we see, with the power of a quantum computer and with some sort of anthropic selection on the outcome, is not an infinitely powerful computer. There are certain computations that you can argue it could not do. And so this opens the possibility that, well, maybe, you know, computational complexity theory has something to say in this more, what seems like this philosophical realm, that if the multiverse could not, if our understanding of the multiverse says it could not solve some problem, and then some physical model comes along and says, well, maybe it can solve that problem, well, that's an interesting tension that might lead to, you know, interest for us, and I'll try to make some precise statements of that sort. Okay, so some sort of. I'm going to exactly try to state my assumptions precisely. I think the whole point of this is to try to make any statement to make any statements along these lines. There are many assumptions, and so you can judge, you know, to what extent I stated my assumptions precisely. That's, you know, do they follow? Yes. Okay. So let's look at this problem of the cosmological constant, because it's one of our, you know, main theoretical motivations for not just dismissing all these big numbers as, you know, the wrong answer. And so in particular, we'll look at the Busa-Polchinsky model for a set of flux vacua that could contain vacua that, that realize the observed value of the cosmological constant. We're granting, of course, that it's a cosmological constant. And so that model says that there's some energy or effective potential, which is the sum of contributions one for each flux. We have this internal manifold, a Calabi-Yau or something, and then it has k, we'll say, different cycles. So maybe B3 of the Calabi-Yau is k, and then we're going to postulate quantized fluxes on the different cycles, a vector, which we'll call, I guess, f in z to the k. And then the energy is just f squared with some sort of generic dependence on moduli at a Calabi-Yau assumed. So we'll write gij fi fj to model that. And we just take some fixed set of coefficients here. We neglect all the subsequent steps of showing that the moduli gets stabilized and so forth. I've spoken at length about how you study that, and to some extent it confirms, you know, certain aspects of this picture. Okay, and now there's some assumed fixed negative energy source, and so there's this very clear picture as to why you might expect some large set of vacua to contain vacua that have a small V, and that's the cosmological constant, which we can just exploit pictorially, as in the original paper. We have this lattice ZK sitting in a two-dimensional projection, but in any case, you know, a k-dimensional space. And now each distance from the origin to a lattice point squared is a contribution. It was a possible contribution, F squared contribution to the vacuum energy. And now we're looking for points that sit at exactly radius squared V naught up to some sort of observational accuracy, which is certainly better than this 10 to the minus 122. And so the question is, do you expect there to be lattice points in this tiny sphere around the origin? And it's very intuitive and possible that if we define our convention so that the volume of a cell of the lattice is 1, that if the sphere is a volume, you know, not that much bigger than 1, then just on, you know, statistical grounds, the points you know, we're not really going to take a cubic lattice, we're taking some more generic form here. The points are sufficiently close to being randomly distributed that there's roughly one per lattice cell, and so if this has a volume greater than one, you expect to find lattice points there. So that's the type of argument, and obviously it's a very general argument. It did not really rely on the specific assumed form here. It's really statistical in nature. Okay, so now we grant that type of picture, and we... yeah, that's right. V0 has to be, if these are order 1, then depending on k, you know, k could be 100 and V0 could be order 10, but that's right. If you're down in the non-universal regime, obviously the argument I just described won't work, but it's easy to find plausible V0s. That it doesn't have to be big. It does not have to be large in order 1. You know, it can be order 1 in the sense of 10, if, 50. Okay, so now now let's suppose that this actually is the way that things play out. I hear David continually sighing at this, and I agree, I can imagine better conclusions to the story, but let's, just take the evidence at hand and, see where it leads us. And so things play out this way, and there's some, very, very much fancier version of this equation, but which forced the problem is not so totally different from studying this equation that we'll just take this as a model and say, well, suppose we could literally compute the coefficients, we solve some PDEs and pick our Fuchs equations and so forth, or sum up instant times, and we literally compute these exact coefficients and now ask, for that system with a given k and a given set of exact coefficients, could I actually find those values of the fluxes that sit in this sphere, in this little shell? And so that's a well-posed computational problem at this point. And again, it's kind of representative. There are even simpler problems of this type that people pose for the landscape. Okay, so I'll say it as the BP problem. Okay, so very shortly we're going to start reviewing a bit of this basic complexity theory, and the people talk about problem classes and different problems. And so this is the BP problem. Does such a given this data, does a lattice point exist in here? Does there exist, f such that v according to that formula is in lambda mod minus lambda mod, well, lambda is effectively zero, but I'm just going to write it anyways. Yeah. Okay.
I guess it depends on what
right. No, it depends on the dependence. I mean, really, for the I'm going to talk about far more general models than this shortly. I mean, that's right. Any specific result for this equation would be invalidated. But I will come at things from enough different points of view to address that type of question. So, this is obviously a drastic oversimplification of the real equations in string theory. We all, that's obvious from the start. So, indeed, if anything I was saying was specific to this particular type of equation, it would not be of such great interest here. And so I will come on to, Yeah. Now, already in the Giddings, Catchew, Polchinski, the effective formula is more complicated because the G's depend on moduli and the moduli depend on fluxes. So, indeed, it's just very easy to take steps beyond this toy version. No, I'm not at all assuming it. I'm illustrating a general property of a class of problems, and you're not going to let me. Let me explain the type of statement I'm trying to make before you discuss to what extent. I make no claims that the final, this will be a part of the equations in the final formulation of string theory. You will. That is the BP model. Yes, that is the BP model. I'm taking it. Indeed, you can propose a better model, and then we can come back to it along the lines on that to pursue with this model. I'm going to throw out another model just to, again, you know, we're making much more generic statements than the questions that you're asking are relevant for. Okay, so this is a model where you have k-scalar fields and a potential that basically looks like a sum of I from 1 to k, some vi of phi I, where these have several minima. And you can just take copies of the same thing, but they should achieve several different possible values. Let's, in fact, simplify things even further. Let's say that vi is cubic, so phi cubed minus x phi squared xi for a given I. And one minimum is at 0, and another is at, you know, the value, you know, v, you know, let's say v bar of I that you get by minimum, you know, just plugging in. It's obviously just cubic and the x more or less. So x cubed over 6 or something like that. Okay, so that's a simple toy model where now the different points in the landscape are parameterized by a choice of vacuum for each of these scalar fields. So phi I either equal is taken out of the set 0, xi, and the potential just reduces to the sum of some subset of the xi, or b of xi. So the ni's are either 0 or 1. And that's an even more simplified version of the landscape, which the, you know, actual, you know, distribution of the vacuum is very different, of course. In this case, it's basically governed by the central limit theorem, and you get some peaking of the distribution, but it also shares this property of having a discretum of possible values, and you might consider it. To make a stable theory, to not run away in some direction, yes. So let's make one of the minima. Yeah. My point. See, I don't regard this as a realistic model at all. I'm not even going to discuss how realistic this one is. But the point I want to make is not that. The point is, suppose you believed in one of these models, how hard now would it be to find the, let me, since I set the base point to be 0 here, we're again going to subtract off a lambda naught, so that we're trying now to find a subset. Okay, so does there exist a choice of ni's from 0, 1 such that sum of ni, you know, v of xi, so these are definite numbers, vi, is within minus lambda naught minus epsilon, lambda naught plus epsilon. Okay, so it's a similar type of problem out of a different distribution, a different discrete one. Okay, so now you can try to go to computer scientists and ask, well, do they think these are easy problems or hard problems? And the basic answer is that these are hard problems in general. Okay, if you want to find that lattice point, you had better have a very fast computer. Okay, so now how can you make that more precise? Okay, well, the basic theory, okay, there's a lot you can say about, you know, specific algorithms for computers, but that's right, but now you want to prove it. Now you want to prove it. No, it's definitely not the case that just showing that the volume of this region is, you know, say, 2 or 2 to the n or something guarantees. No, it does not. It does not. If you make it sufficiently big, if you make the shell sufficiently big, you could prove it. Okay, but now suppose you either this shell is not sufficiently big, or let me put another problem of this sort, the min BP problem. We'll come back to why you might consider this. Okay, which is the minimum positive V out of this set. Okay, there's some reasons why you might look for that one, which I'll come back to discussing. And the, you know, the point that I'm going to make is that definitely there are easy cases of this problem where it's easy to prove that there's no point or there is a point. But now we're scanning over all problems, and we're going to, for some time now, start making worst case statements. Okay, that's a nature, that's one type of statement that comes out as complexity theory. You know, we didn't choose these numbers. You know, what is the worst case? Yeah?
Do you want to show the existence, or do you need to actually define the
last one? You just need to show the existence. Okay, there's another problem to actually find it, but the problem we're posing now is just to show its existence.
And you really think it doesn't depend on
the of course it depends. It depends crucially. This is the data. So given Gij and V, is this the case? Okay, so yeah, that's right. So if you're going to go talk to a computer scientist, I will tell you this from personal experience. You know, they are not going to listen to very much discussion of where this Gij came from. And so you're going to have to just say, well, they're going to take your word that you're the physicist. You have your reasons for liking your model. Give us the Gij and let's see what we can do with it. Okay, so we're going to put on this different hat for a moment. And yeah.
The assumption that computing the contribution from a given app is at least as complicated as calculating the quadratic equation, and that there's no major structure which allows you to simplify the
Well, we're certainly going to be making a worst case statement at this point. That's right. I mean, it's definitely complexity theory talks about classes of problems and not, you know, a specific problem. There are many specific cases of that problem which are very easy.
Think of those black boxes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the spirit of the type of statement we will make. And again, I will make them, you know, in a broad enough class of examples to not get too hung up over the specifics of this one. Okay. So indeed, this is how you would have to phrase it to get into this domain of complexity theory. You know, you would first of all, you know, to make it, a general enough problem that this field has anything to say, you would talk about some class of problems where, you know, you don't assume you know the Gij, but just, you know, for whatever Gij you're given, satisfying some conditions. You know, you might say you know a lot about the Gij in some precise way. You know, then how hard is it to solve this problem? Okay, and then that's a question you could address. Now, the second thing, which leads to this very kind of well-developed and deep theory, is not even to address a specific problem in the sense of a specific K, but to address a family of problems that can grow in size. Okay, so a problem, you're given input, and you're supposed to get out an output, but for us, we're going to talk about decision problems, where output is either yes or no. So does there exist such a vacuum? So that simplifies things to some extent. And now you write some program and you have some computer. We're not going to at all get into the details of that, but the question in some sense is, you know, how many time steps or how many computational steps did it require to get that output? And can you say for all the programs and computers of some type, what is the minimum T to solve that class of T doesn't literally have to be time. It might be that you build some sort of big circuit, you know, and then you would be saying, well, how many, you know, components do I need in my circuit? What is the depth of the circuit? You know, what is the longest path that the computation has to trace through to get to the output? And so you know, it's certainly a measure of the complexity, but you don't have to think of it as time. Okay, for our purpose, of course, here it's time. You know, for here, you may well want to be more general. Okay, so now, you know, again, it's kind of a detailed thing, but now we'll talk about some measures of problem size. Okay, and so obviously the K here is a controlling measure of the problem size, and also some measure of how complicated these things would be. You know, so like if you actually had to put in binary numbers for these things, you might want to ask, well, how many bits do I have to put in? Number of bits in input and so forth. And again, we're not going to get into the details here where we care, but you would make some precise definition of this sort, and then, for some broad theoretical purpose, you would only be interested in results for which the details of this sort of thing don't really matter very much. Any computer, what's something like this you could say for more or less any type of computer, any definition of this, reasonable definition of the size of your problem and so forth. And now you might try to, you might think, well, we've stripped away all the details of the problem. What could we possibly say about that? But there is something you can say. You can try to get some sort of asymptotic bound on the difficulty of solving this problem. So you might, conjecture to solve this BP problem. Well, there's an obvious algorithm, more or less, which basically says, you can easily, put a bound, that you don't have to consider lattice points too far out. They could never satisfy this. So you first reduced it to a finite problem. There's a problem that you could run for some finite amount of time, explore any lattice point that could potentially solve the problem. But then the most kind of stupid algorithm you could make was just go through all the lattice points and try them all. And so that's a valid solution to the problem. The number of lattice points grows as, something like V0 to the K that you should have to consider. And so it's clear that you can solve it in some sort of time which is exponential in K with, some coefficient there, but exponential time. Okay, so it's clear you can do that. And the conjecture that you might study is, well, exists something which, so solve BP, we know we can do it in that, so there exists a way to solve BP faster than this kind of stupid approach. I mean, you can say question. Okay, so, right, yeah, that's right. So what is the number of points? Obviously it's infinite, but by the definition of the problem, there's a maximum V that we're interested in. And clearly if you go off in any direction, eventually it's obvious that you can't satisfy this. And by thinking about the geometry of this ellipsoid and diagonalizing it over the reals. So it's a much easier problem if you're allowed to work over the reals. That we could all solve. What makes it difficult is the integer nature, the constraint to be integers. But you can, of course, use the structure of your reals to produce some bound that tells you that, well, the integers can't get so much bigger than such and such, and get some sort of region like this where it's fairly obvious that the solutions must sit inside here. I hope that's intuitive, because I don't, that's right. And now you've reduced it to a finite problem, and now the obvious algorithm that presents itself the volume is exponential in K, and you had to search every lattice point. So you know you can do it that fast. So question, is there a way to solve this problem faster than exponential as you scale up the size of the problem for this generic thing? And yeah. In bits, that's right, in bits. We're asking an approximate question, so there's some sufficient accuracy that you would have to give the coefficients to, given the epsilon. No, we're only going to mean length of the bits at this point. I mean, that's right, there are more sophisticated things you could talk about, but we're going to talk about length, number of bits, and we're going to make statements that don't care about, the fact that it was base 2 and that level of detail. That's right, we could come back to other things we could discuss. Oh yeah, well that's right. This is a piece of a bigger problem. Suppose that's right. You should talk about the complexity of computing these elements and so forth. I'm just talking about this piece. No, you could consider a family of, you consider this GIJ. You could consider a family of GIJs that tracks this, volume of roughly 1.
Suppose volume is
There will come a volume here where the things start to become easier, which will be roughly 2 to the k. And with some, yeah. Yeah, but we don't have to list them for our definition of the problem. We just have to ask whether there is one. Yeah, that's right. Now, this is important to get these sorts of statements that are problem. Right, we stated a problem that doesn't require giving a list or the number of solutions, just to show that there is one. Okay, so that's a well-defined question, and you can ask people what they think about it, and I'll come back to what they think about it, but what they kind of say is, that's an interesting question, which is a lot like questions that people have studied. We didn't quite study that one, but it turns out to be fairly easy to make an argument that makes the sort of claim I'm about to make for this problem, which now let's come down to this problem. Okay, so similar question for this ADK model. You can make the similar statement that the number of solutions, number of points you have to test goes as 2 to the k. Seems like the problem is very much simpler than that, and so you might think that this one is very much simpler. Okay, but now this is a problem which people have studied. Okay, so this is sometimes called the subset sum problem or the knapsack problem. Okay, and strictly speaking, what you do is you would round everything off here to integers, and you would now get some list of, I don't mean round everything off, I mean given your precision. Say your precision is 10 to the minus 122, well, you can scale the whole problem up. You can multiply everything by 10 to the 122 so that your error bound is of order 1. And now decide, well, you know, there are really certain integers that would fall in this range. I'm going to now round these guys off to integers and get essentially the same problem, you know, measured in this original unit, 10 to the minus 122, but now to find a subset of integers which sits, you know, realizes one of a specified finite list of integers. It's essentially the same problem under this constraint that, well, we're really going to put in finite length binary numbers that approximate these things, and we're allowed to do that as long as we're sufficiently good to, you know, capture the, you know, structure on this scale epsilon. Okay, so that problem is known to be NP complete. And so that means if you find this for the general version of the ADK problem, you know, something that scales up to any k in any list of these, then you solve this famous question of whether the class P equals a class NP. Yeah?
You have to specify how epsilon and k interact?
The way I just said it, we have taken epsilon basically to be fixed as k went up. So we've scaled out. So the essential point for the result I'm directly drawing on is that there'd be a finite set of integers. We're asking whether it sits within this finite set. So it doesn't have anything to do with k. It has to do with the the scale here and this question of approximation. Yeah. Okay. So this now makes you think that, well, you know, maybe there is something harder about this problem, because lots of people have been trying to address this question. And the first thing is to say that nobody really knows. You know, there, you know, could be that such an algorithm exists. Nobody proved it couldn't, but this is the sort of thing people have been looking at for 30 years, and they haven't found one yet, nor have they proven that it doesn't exist. Okay, so let's be a little more specific about what that term means so that we can decide if it really has any implications for this problem. Okay. You know, of course, I'm going to come back and tell you that, you know, both of these are, but this is, again, a concrete one which is much discussed in literature. And in fact, you know, there are more basic ones than that. So I'll talk a little bit now about this computer science background. Okay, so what is P, NP, NP hard, NP complete? Okay, so P means you think about this and you come up with some algorithm or some, you know, you argue there's some algorithm where the time t is bounded above by some polynomial. in the problem size, you know, so it could be k to some n, you know, it could be k to some fairly large n for all one knows, but the reason people work with this, and you know, there are many results that talk about the specific n, you know, in the context of a specific algorithm, you get a specific n, and the advantage of being so general is that now questions like, well, you know, which kind of machine did you use, which kind of language, you know, suppose you have 1,000 Turing machines instead of one, all become an essential because there's this huge class of transformations you can do that at least retain this property that they only, say, square the running time or do some other polynomial operation. Yeah.
Just to be clear, this is
presumably
understood in the limit
of state goes from things.
Exactly, it's an asymptotic
statement.
You have to keep n finite.
Well, the n is a question of the algorithm, and that's right. So it's a question that this is, that's right, not growing faster than some polynomial, that's right, with a fixed, yes. I mean, there are things that are sub-exponential, but for this, that's right, it's really, there is some polynomial, you know, that provides the asymptotic bound. Okay, so that's true of a lot of things. And very often when this is true, you know, people think about this, and they do find some clever way to bring down the n. You know, so for example, when you multiply two matrices, obviously, you know, the dimension is the k, and you think at first it must take, you know, k cubed, you know, the dimension of the matrix cubed, if you just think about how many multiplies and adds you have to do. But it turns out that you can bring it down to like 2.1 or something, you know, if you're really clever. And it's something which is, you know, terrible for small matrices, but if they were million by million matrices, this would make a big difference. And so that's, you know, an example of, you know, detailed knowledge of this coefficient is, you know, very interesting, but obviously more specific to the problem. Okay, so now what does NP mean? Well, it doesn't mean this. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to take longer. What it means is that you can check. So there exists something that they would call a witness. Okay, so in this particular case at hand, it's very simple, the flux. You know, there exists a flux F such that checking the answer takes time p. So you can check the answer in polynomial time. You know, not yes, no, but there is some simple thing somebody could give you that you could check. You know, and if it, you know, if it's true, then it's yes. So here is to say that you know, there is this flux, and if somebody did tell you the flux, you would very easily convince yourself that yes, he did solve the problem. Stands for non-deterministic polynomial. And another definition, which is kind of harder to think about, I mean, it suggests all sorts of implications that aren't totally valid, is that you imagine that you're running this on a computer, which at every step is allowed to make a guess. You know, it just has some choice. You know, I tried this in this dimension, I tried this. And then you just grant that it always guesses right. And then it has to solve the problem in p time. So that's another somewhat less concrete. So you don't have to talk about you know, the witness or the specific answer. You know, as Sergey pointed out, you know, sometimes you don't want to have to talk about the actual answer, but it's better to phrase it this way, you know, that there does exist, you know, some proof or some answer that would convince you in p time. Okay, so that's the NP, and this is manifestly an NP. Okay, so now there's the question of NP hard, because NP hard means that, so, you know, A is NP hard if all the NP problems B can somehow be recoded into problems A. Okay, so this is to say that suppose, I'll just say the usual way people to say this now, suppose I have some sort of a magic box, okay, which takes the A problem, you know, like the Busso-Polchinski answer. Okay, so I put in the G and the V naught, and I get out, you know, the flux or this yes-no in a single step, and you know, it just magically solves that problem. Okay, and if you're given that, you know, it's actually not too big a step from the yes-nos into the F. You know, you can very efficiently search this space if people are going to tell you, well, yes, this region contains one, this region doesn't, and so forth. You know, but anyhow, this sort of black box is called an oracle. And it's just a theoretical device that you postulate. And now the claim is basically that there should be some way, you should be able to demonstrate that there's some way that, you know, any NP problem somehow could be reformulated as a problem that you could hand to the A, and it could solve, and you could turn that back into the answer. Okay, and so why would you ever think there were any such magic problems of this sort? Okay, well, this is now, you know, I'll talk about this idea of NP complete. Basically, this is something which is both NP hard and also NP, so it's not harder than it has to be. There might be some magic box that can solve all problems, and clearly it can do that. You know, but in fact, you can do it with a box which just solves an NP problem. Okay, so the canonical in the first example is a problem called SAT, which is to satisfy a set of logical propositions. Okay, so I don't know if it's worth my going into great detail about the computer science, because I have, you know, other quasi-physics points to make, but the point is that if you have a box which you're given some big logical formula, you know, if, you know, either, you know, X and Y or this and that and the other thing, instantly tells you, is this a consistent formula? You know, is there some set of saying this, you know, assignments of truth values to variables, this one is true and that one is false and so forth, that makes the formula true, or does that not exist? Okay, if you could just solve that problem, you can show that that's NP, because, well, it's obviously an NP because you can check. You know, if somebody tells you if X is true and Y is false, you just plug it all into the formula and you check, and indeed it's true. And so you can, it's clearly an NP, and then the non-trivial claim is that you can really express every NP problem in this way. And the idea, not to go into any details, is that the definition, of course, is that you can write this computer program that checks. So here was the definition of NP. There must be some computer program you can write that can check the answer in this polynomial time. So you just basically formulate a big proposition, a logical proposition that says, you know, I ran my program and it checked the answer and the answer was right. You know, so that's something, you know, for any given language, there is a concrete translation of program, running the program and so forth into some huge logical statement. And then you feed it into SAT and it does all the job of running the program and checking the answer and seeing if it was right. And if you now start asking questions, or you can just ask, well, did there exist one? Well, that's a simpler, you know, simpler to just ask, does there exist one, than, you know, does this one work? And so the SAT oracle can do that too. So, yeah.
When you reduce from B to A, are you assuming that reduction doesn't take that much time?
Yes, yeah, polynomial time. Always in polynomial. That's right.
Be hard after polynomial time.
That's right. Okay, so that's the definition, and so that's the implication if you say that a problem is then can be completed, is that you can solve SAT and all the other problems. You prove this by showing that you can take a system, say, of Boolean expressions, and then turn the SAT problem just into a big set of numbers, and you know, run it through the, you know, this you know, ADK problem solver and get the answer, and you solve everything. You know, and there are actually details of the argument we were reviewing on the blackboard in the common room, so I won't give it here. Anyhow, that's the idea, and so the fact that claiming that you have an algorithm that can solve this problem in such generality would have such dramatic consequences, generally leads people to think that, well, you know, this would be nice, but probably we have that, and therefore that. And again, it's not proven, but that's the type of argument. Okay, so this one you can actually take special cases and reduce it to this subset sum problem, the BP thing. You know, in fact, if you just take the special case where the matrix is diagonal, it starts to look a lot more like this. And now you have to find a way to stick in the constraint that, you know, each flux can only be 0 or 1, and you more or less turned it into that. And you can do that. So in fact, you know, in this kind of asymptotic sense of, you know, allowing yourself to consider huge problems, they're all equally difficult and all NP complete. Okay, so now this is a very non-physical argument and says nothing direct about the difficulty of doing this for 100 boxes, 500 boxes, and so forth. You know, it's really much more of a mathematical argument than now you can still say. You know, maybe there's, you know, only 100 boxes, maybe there's special structure in the problem that helps me. And all that is very true. You know, certainly we don't want to say there's no hope of solving these problems, but you have to somehow know something about the problem. Now, you can also, yeah.
So are
square root of k or something.
Let's see. So that would be to say that that's right. NP actually can be solved in some sub-exponential time in general. That's right. That's different. That's right. That's different from P not equal to NP. There is some reason people don't believe that, but that's right. It's certainly consistent with what I was saying. Yeah. No, this problem is not in P, because if I consider this big class of all Ks, all Gijs, it's NP complete. I can take any of these problems and encode it into a huge Busso-Polchinski type problem. So maybe it's in P, but that implies everything else is in P.
Thanks,
Joe. Okay, so there's a lot of actually interesting connections between this and spin glasses and statistical physics, because these sorts of complicated potential landscapes depending on many variables obviously come up in a lot of contexts, and that's a sort of more physical argument. And I'll just kind of say in a nutshell, because I want to say other things, that in some physical language, one of the ways of thinking about the difficulty is that it's very easy, obviously, I didn't phrase these ones, but all these problems you can set up as the problem, say, of minimizing a potential. So I started with this kind of gravity thing, but you could, of course, square the difference between this guy. You basically could square this guy and say now you're trying to minimize the square of the cosmological constant. So it's a minimization of a potential. And so now what's that potential going to look like? Well, obviously it's going to be very complicated, and it's going to have lots of local minima all over the place. Okay, so now what would you say? What would the physicists propose as the general way to solve this problem? Well, we got this potential. We just start at some point and we do the attractor mechanism, if you will, this gradient flow. We just start heading down the potential gradient and we end up in some minimum. And so if it were a very simple potential with one minimum, that would obviously work. The statement is that these potentials just have so many local minima that this is pretty useless. You're always going to get stuck in one of the other exponentially large set of local minima. And then you can try various other, you can see that this problem has this character. If you just change one flux, the energy typically jumps by a lot. And so another way of approaching might say is, the problem is you got stuck in this local minimum. Maybe if we were more gentle, kept ourselves at finite temperature, explore more and more of the configuration space, at the early stages, focus on the right thing, and then gradually lower the temperature, focus in, and eventually we'll get down to the right thing. Okay, so this would be annealing, in some physical context. Obviously, the fact that you get caught up in here is the reason why glass is glass and not a crystal. You cool things, and certain potentials that come for realistic materials have this structure, and you get caught in a metastable minimum. So anyhow, it's true. There is a universal solution of that sort that gradually lowers the temperature and is guaranteed to end up there, but it takes exponential time. That's how slowly you have to lower the temperature. Okay, so people kind of thought about it from that angle, and there's a lot of interesting things to say, but time presses for us. So now, here's another angle, which is very interesting once we move on to the cosmology. Okay, this is all a classical computer, but what if we had a quantum computer? Wouldn't that be great? Isn't that what isn't that what we're about to spend millions of dollars here to do? And certainly when we get to cosmology, of course we should grant the universe is a quantum computer, of course. And so you can ask exactly the same question, and now there are parallel complexity classes. People have had a few years to think about this, and they've thought about this. So the natural analog of P is BQP, which the Q is obviously quantum, and the B takes into account the fact that you're never really guaranteed. It's all probabilistic. But if you get an answer, within this polytime, the answer has probability P greater than, let's say, 2/3 of being correct. Okay, and you might say, oh, two-thirds, that's not very good. I would never use such a computer. But in fact, you do use such computers because the standard primality test until very recently had just this character that sometimes would tell you that the number is prime, but you know, very often would not give a result. You use some randomness in the algorithm. So what do you do with it? Well, you just run it 100 times, and now you have probability of two-thirds to the 1 minus two-thirds to the 100. To be correct, this is very good actually. If you think about it, this is actually almost as good from this practical point of view as a totally reliable computer. And there are lots of randomized algorithms out there. Okay, so now you could talk about things like NQP, because the sort of quote non-determinism that we talked about here has nothing to do with quantum mechanics, and you could just phrase the problem this way. Phrasing it right is kind of technical, and I won't go into that. Now, at this point, again, nobody proved it. There are definitely problems that sit somewhere in here, on this classical side. So the most famous example is factoring. Factoring is not NP, but certainly also not proven to be NP complete. It's certainly an NP. You can check a factorization, but people tend not to think it's NP complete, but they didn't prove that either. And now over here, factoring is definitely in this class. You can factor really fast. You can factor 15 in a nanosecond. But it uses very special properties of this factoring problem. And the discoverer of this, Peter Shor, is justly celebrated, but it has not generalized. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence for a fairly simple hypothesis about the generalization, which is that suppose the problem took time t, so T for the classical, so conjecture. You won't find people really, maintaining this conjecture in a strong way, but definitely it's implicitly there in the literature. Then takes square root of T for the quantum computer. And what exists is that there are problems for which you realize exactly the speed up. So the Grover search algorithm is exactly this. You find one entry in some big database, and it's very easy to show. You can exactly speed it up. It would have been exponential. You would have had to search through, if you had an n bit address, 2 to the n entries, and now you can do it in that time square root of t. That's a precise limit for this problem. And then the general sense is that, well, certainly to the extent that you don't explore any structure into the problem, it's just like that. It's just some needle in the haystack, and you're just trying to find out one item out of 2 to the n. And then there are many ways known to get exactly this speed up to 2 to the n over 2, and not better. You can prove in this kind of Grover case that you can't do better. Yeah, the Shor algorithm is an exception because the structure in the problem that lets you do it is you can phrase the problem of factoring as finding the periodicity of a sequence of numbers. You take some number and you raise it to a power mod the number of interest, and then say x. Then that if it's prime, that would have periodicity x minus 1, and if it's composite, it would have a shorter periodicity. And then you use that, and then it is true Fourier transform is something quantum mechanics does really well. And so that's what you use, and that's how the algorithm works. And people have, yeah.
Can you make this more precise? Are you saying an upper bound for 1 implies an upper bound?
No. People study actively the relation between these problems, but there's certainly no theorem of this sort. It's just a kind of empirical at this point.
I'm trying to understand why Shor is an exception. So it's supposed to be an equivalence?
No. Definitely, it's a generic, empirical statement at this point that there are problems for which this is precise, like the Grover.
Most number theorists think factoring is easy, just that we don't know how to do it. So
that could be. So that would certainly be consistent with everything I'm saying. So basically, the precise statement of the sort is in a paper I can give you the reference of Bennett et al. That basically says if the solution, there's some oracle, that tells you, this is the right one, and that's the definition of the problem to find the right one, then this is the best you can do. Yeah.
There's a wide class of problems which are essentially quantum mechanics problems, which you can simulate.
Yeah, that's right. And where all the classical algorithms are known are exponential. That's right. So it certainly is this, very interesting class where, you've gained a lot from a quantum computer, but it does not seem to include these traditional NP hard problems. That's right. It's not just factoring. The other obvious application is indeed to fermionic quantum Monte Carlo and that sort of thing. Yeah.
You can't check the polynomial time, or
Ah, okay. If I have time, I don't know how much longer you want to listen to this stuff, but now let's talk about... Okay, 12:30. Okay, so now let's talk about the min-BP problem. Okay, so this is the problem of... we don't just want one. We want the guy with the minimum positive cosmological constant. Okay, well, that's clearly not obvious how to check, right? If somebody gives you it, how do you know it's the minimum, right? Okay, so now why would we care about this problem? Okay, well, this is where things sort of start to get amusing, because of course there's this famous proposal, okay, now in quantum cosmology, that says that to perhaps entitle it after its most famous former proponent or something, that the cosmological constant is probably zero. Okay, and this is to say that suppose there's some measure factor, amplitude, probability, or whatever, on the vacuum, and we're going to let it depend on all the choices in principle, but the one that we're going to study is just this, 1 over some normalization, e to the 1 over lambda, some 3/8 and m Planck's in there and so forth. But that's the essential nature of this proposal. So, this has many arguments, which I may come back to and evaluate, but it's certainly not the purpose of my talk, nor am I an expert in this field. One famous source of this type of factor is the Hartle-Hawking wave function under certain interpretations. Now, you can certainly debate, we could have a whole other talk debating, would it be valid for me to take that probability amplitude and say that I'm going to pick out the minimum lambda here, okay? Because, of course, that's what this effectively does. For almost any reasonable distribution, discrete form of vacua, this heavily concentrates on the minimum. We're going to grant that this is only for lambda greater than zero, one of the problems with this, but we'll just grant it, okay, on minimum lambda greater than zero. So a very, very good approximation, it just selects that one. If it's 10 to the minus 122 sitting there, then it's just the probability of anything else is negligible. Okay, so if we believe that quantum cosmology gave us that measure factor, then we would come back here and say, well, no, it's not good enough just to find one. You got to find the minimum one. Okay, and now you can discuss that problem. Okay, so min BP is, yeah. Well, indeed, I agree. I'm not going to claim that I know the mechanism. I'm going to come back. See, this is a very deep thing, okay? When you ask mechanism, what does cosmology do? I will come back and address some of these things. Let's not address mechanism at the moment.
You're going to tell me about the state, maybe completely irrelevant.
I'm going to try to draw something out of this. You can judge at the end, whether what I'm going to say, has any deep significance or not. I don't think it's very deep, but I think it has some significance. So, okay. So anyhow, we'll grant this, and we'll just ask, how hard is this for a computer? And, it's kind of intuitive that, this problem doesn't appear to be an NP. How do you check? In polynomial time, that your candidate vacuum is the minimum. Well, it's obviously hard to do that. And so the response of this community is not necessarily to find ways to do it. It's to say, we have a new complexity class. Let us name it. And so what is this one called? This one, the basic property that this problem has is that you can easily check if your candidate is false. Okay, so min, okay, so now it's hard to check if you got the minimum, but it's easy for somebody to convince you that you didn't get the minimum because there will be some other vacuum W such that it has a lower. Okay, so this is not net of V. Okay, so this is just a problem of the same type that we were discussing. If somebody gives you the W, he can prove you're wrong, but it's much harder to prove you're right. Okay, so this has a name, this negation. You see, you can't just, the negation of a formula is a formula, but a negation of this weird thing here is something else. Another way to say it is that min requires saying for all W's. This is not true. So when you negate through a, there exists, it becomes for all. Okay, and so given that this guy is an NP, this is given the name co-NP, just as the complement of the things that are in, logical complement of an NP, not in some sort of, big set, but just you can test the complement of the condition in NP time. Okay, so now there's a string of arguments which are fascinating, but if people want that, we'll outline. Okay, maybe, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting stuff that suggests that NP is different from co-NP. And so now the problem at hand has basically both. You know, we certainly had to solve the original problem of showing that there was a candidate, and we have to show that it's the minimum. So the min BP problem is something that basically some allowed flux is both in an NP set and in a co-BP set. Okay, so this doesn't say that it's in the intersection of these things. It says it's in some bigger class that contains aspects of both. And then this has the name DP, difference between an NP and another NP. And again, there are arguments to the effect that DP is harder than either NP or co-P. I mean, it certainly reduces to both of them, but it is strictly harder. Okay, and then many people, there are DP complete problems. So for example, the famous traveling salesman problem. So you have the cities, and you're trying to find a tour that visits each one. And now you can ask a question like, is there a path of length less than L? Well, that's like this. It's also NP complete and very similar. Is the minimum path less than L? Well, that's like this. And that's been shown to be DP complete. Okay, so there's a further tower of things which I may come back and call upon, but I'm afraid I won't have time for everything I want to say. That the next step up from this are things that you say like there exists V1 for all V2 something. Okay, so you're kind of putting not just two conditions but two in a certain order, and then that's called sigma 2. And an example of that might be, not only do we want a vacuum, but we want all the barrier heights around it to be sufficiently high that it's metastable, right? So it's obviously hard to check that, and now there's some ordering that first we have to find a vacuum down there and then check the guys around it, so that's probably in sigma 2. And then you can kind of iterate this, okay? So if you're in the spirit, sigma n is the things where you have a game between two players, and you can make n, player one moves, player two moves, player one moves, player two moves, up to n moves, and then there's a winner. Given the rules, does black or white, black or white have a winning strategy? That is a problem in sigma n. Okay, so you can continue, and then there are even harder things than that. Okay, so now, so we saw that DP made an appearance, and there are good reasons to think that DP is harder than these. If DP is equal to these, it turns out all these classes are the same. Okay, sort of a higher level version of this P equals NP, and then the people have evidence against that. Okay, so I'm going to come back to some of this stuff in a bit, but let me, if people have questions about this, that's fine, and otherwise I'll continue in this vein of, does the questions of, does the fact that these vacua are difficult to find in this sense have any implications for cosmology? Okay, why should it? Okay, should I? This is this more kind of down-to-earth question. And again, the message is not so much that we should give up. We can never solve these problems. It's that you have to exploit some sort of deeper structure in the problem. And it could be, for example, and I may come back to more concrete proposals that, again, there's some dual reformulation of, say, this problem that, for exactly the string theory case, makes that one much easier. So I will come back to that type of idea in this context. But now I'm going to switch to this potential paradox of, well, it's hard. Maybe it's hard for us to find the right vacuum in either of these senses. But should we care? If we decide that the universe finds it hard, what does that mean? And it's certainly easy to say, well, it doesn't mean anything. The universe doesn't find anything. In fact, the universe is not a computer. And the precise sense in which the universe is not a computer for these arguments is not that every step in the computation, we have some physical model, we propose some cosmological model, and it is some formal system. I may use complex numbers or other mathematics, but it's definitely a formal system. And we're certainly, as physicists, going to claim that we can model the universe with this formal system. So. Well, I'm going to come back and justify. That's right. I mean, I just said it, and now I have to say In what sense? See, I'm saying that you shouldn't accept that uncritically. Now that we get into the cosmology, Jim has been silent over there, but you would probably agree that the universe in itself is not a computer.
Well, in the sense it's quantum mechanical system.
Right. To something else.
Something that, but doesn't mean it's solving this particular
problem. Well, it's solving some, to the extent that we think that there, we have a model, we can regard it as a system solving the problem posed by the model. But we don't know that it evolves from something to something else, right? We don't know that there's well-defined state at a given time, right? That's the point that you would, that's the type of issue that I'm...
I think what I mentioned,
yeah. Good. Yeah. Stephen, that's right.
Person, he made this conjecture that nature couldn't solve any problem faster than a visual computer.
And he was wrong.
Some mapping.
Okay. Yeah, because quantum computers can solve problems faster. But now you can make the quantum Wolfram conjecture. And, you know, people have, in fact, I think you've written about the idea that certain definitions of quantum gravity could in fact solve logically unsolvable problems, which again is a bit tangential, but you know, I'm happy to talk about that later. But anyhow, we are now addressing that type of question. You know, should we be bothered if we decide the universe is solving a problem that cannot be solved by a computer? And maybe I'll just skip the philosophy and just kind of cut to the point. Okay, well, should we be bothered if the universe has solved the BP problem and found a vacuum that had, you know, that achieved this small cosmological constant, very, you know, well, you know, let's grant that, you know, the usual inflationary scenario, there's Big Bang, you know, within, you know, a second at the most, you know, we're already pretty close to the minimum. So it solved it pretty fast. And, you know, because of causality, it can't use massive parallelism to do it. Well, can it, right? I mean, that's the usual way out, is to say, well, you know, really there is this multiverse, okay? We don't see all the other components of the multiverse, but under various cosmological models, there can be regions which are separated in, you know, causally in space. There could be regions which are just different components of the wave function. There are various candidate entities within the theories that we take seriously that we might call different components of the multiverse that don't interfere with each other and clearly can work in parallel and try out different solutions to the problem. Okay, now of course, you know, the early question of quantum computing was, you know, could you use that to get a useful result in our universe? And it's very, you know, limited the effect to which you can use interference to get useful results in our universe. You know, very interesting cases, but not in general. But now, of course, we're not asking that. We're asking, can we use this parallelism of the multiverse to argue that the universe, you know, that the multiverse will have no problem producing a universe, you know, that supports, you know, that has the small cosmological constant that realizes all the other conditions that we see around us. And of course the answer is, well, yeah, there's no problem. You know, we just have a 10 to 122 or even more different components of this multiverse, and they're all trying different things, and one of them will be us, and we don't live in the others, and that's a very familiar argument, and there's nothing wrong with it. Like, it postulates the multiverse, but again, you know, it doesn't, you know, you can have philosophical complaints about that, but there's no evidence against that postulate. Okay, so all that is fairly clear. But now I want to claim that under some assumptions, and I'll get to what these are, the multiverse would not be able to solve the min-BP problem. Okay, and obviously that's going to be heavy assumptions because there are cosmological models that lead to exactly this. So it has to be assumptions that are satisfied by those, you know, not satisfied by those cosmological models. Okay, so what's the first step? Well, the first step is to at all take this idea seriously, I think, and to say that, well, even though the multiverse seems infinite, you know, maybe there's a problem that the multiverse can't solve. Okay, and that would be hard for us to imagine, but, you know, as I said, these guys have spent 30 years coming up with, you know, this list of harder and harder and still finite problems. You know, they're all solvable logically, but they take longer and longer. So there's this category at the end of kind of this list, which is P space, which just says you only require polynomial space and any amount of time you want. But it's sort of obvious from that this guy, any such problem can be solved in exponential time because eventually you run into this Poincaré recurrence time. So if the number of storage, you know, if the number of states is, you know, 2 to the polynomial in the time, then you know, you can only occupy each state once. There's this Poincaré return assignment, so that's the maximal length of a commutation. So that's a familiar idea. And of course, you know, some models might grant already, you know, exponential time. But let's come back into this class. Let's ask, suppose we have a multiverse where each branch, you know, decohering, you know, branch of the wave function defined in the, you know, most appropriate way, each branch realizes a quantum computer in a p-time quantum computer. So we take seriously the idea that there was a Big Bang, t equals zero, and then we have the resources of the universe up to t now, and that's not exponential. You know, that's just the sort of comparison I was making over here. If you just have that to play with, then you're using this to attack potentially that. And so definitely the usual physical picture of how things work is consistent with this claim that each branch of the universe realizes BQP. So BQP saying that, well, it is a quantum computer. It has polynomial time. We don't insist that we can make definite predictions, but we can at least make, you know, useful predictions. Okay. A branch is something which we live in and we can't see any other. That's right. We can discuss the details later. For present purposes, it's just going to be now. Yeah. Oh, that's right. I said nothing about the number of branches. There can be infinitely many branches. Yeah, that's right. Okay. But we do insist that we can know something about what's happened. Okay. So here's the philosophical point, which again, maybe we should save detailed discussion about at the end. And it's perfectly, as a philosophical position, I think perfectly consistent to say there are infinitely many branches. They all exist. All possibilities exist. No argument about whether the universe can do that. But now we're somehow trying to bring in the idea that, well, either, you know, we have a model, you know, that describes these branches, you know, and that we can somehow make some prediction from the model that we have any confidence in at all. Okay, and I think that's the point where you would say that, yes, if my model provides the computational resources to realize a quantum computer and I can get any kind of believable prediction out of it at all, it must be that the universe is in this sense doing a computation in this class. Yeah. As long as they never decohere and never talk to each other. You know, at some point it just becomes philosophical. You know, you can just postulate it.
You might have guessed that the number of branches might grow somehow exponentially.
Oh yeah, specific models can. That's right. You might not need infinite. I'm just saying that that's right. A specific model will make a statement about this, and now we're trying to say, you know, within, you know, given a model, what can you hope to say? And so I'm not assuming anything about the number of branches, but I am assuming that we live in one, and we observe, and you know, the universe clearly did realize this cosmological constant, and we don't observe anything which does not, you know, along with, you know, of course you can add not just this, but of course, you know, be inside the whole, you know, anthropically or empirically allowed region. Right, so you can say everything that's anthropically allowed. You can say everything that fits the data to the present accuracy. It doesn't matter so much for the argument at hand. Okay, so testing that, you know, was in P. The universe did it, and generating them is in NP. We don't know how to do it, and now clearly one branch in the universe, by the evidence I just stated, could not do it. You know, it's only in BQP. BQP is much smaller than NP according to this. And on the other hand, now we have this post-selection that says that, well, you know, there can be these many branches and only, you know, we only have to have one get it right, and that's where we live. Okay, so now there is a definition of this class, which is post-BQP, okay, and that is the work of Aronson, which I mentioned, and it's on the web, and it's formally just adding the obvious ingredient. Okay, so formally, you grant that you have this quantum computer, it takes an input, it runs in polyton, it gives you an output. Now you focus on one of these bits. Okay, so there's some, you know, two-dimensional Hilbert space across all the rest. You measure that one and you get either a zero or a one. And if you get a one, you live, you accept it. and if you get a zero, you die. You don't exist in that branch. Okay, so that you could regard as a definition of a computer, which if you really truly believed in the multiverse, you know, of course, you would accept that this is a valid way to perform a computation. Now, of course, few people are willing to bet their life or their cat or their house on this, but in any case, it's an easy definition to make formally, to say what is the class of things that I can run a quantum computer, apply this post-selection, and now insist that the probability of getting a correct answer is better than, say, two-thirds. You know, the precise number doesn't matter so much because of this, you know, possibility of raising it to a power in this definition. You know, for making this formal definition, you can run the computer more than once. Okay, and so Aaronson proves that this equals another previously defined class PP, which sits somewhere in between these things. Okay, in fact, the definition is very simple. PP are the classical computers which are probabilistic and, you know, run for polynomial time, and the probability of correctness is greater than a half. Okay, so that was the original definition of probabilistic computer. And the difference, okay, you might start saying, well, it's greater than a half. Why can't I start doing the same thing and get a reliable answer? Of course, the difference is that as the problem gets bigger and bigger, it might be that this drops down closer and closer to a half, you know, in a way that makes it more and more useless. And more or less, you know, informally, it's to say that the computer only knows one thing. You know, it sees one example of the problem that it knows, and it says, ha, I know that one, and it gets it correct. And otherwise, it flips a coin. And that's in PP. You know, it has a chance greater than one half of getting the right answer. So it's a very, very broad class. And that's what you can do if you're allowed arbitrary post-selection at this point. And it's an interesting, has interesting theoretical applications, this theorem. But for present purposes, what attracted us is the fact that it's believed to be smaller than this P space. And there is an example of a problem in P space, which is P space complete and generally believed not to be in PP. And the problem is, consider the same two-player game I was talking about here. You know, you get the rules, there's white and black, they alternate. But instead of there being some fixed length of the game n, the length of the game grows with the size of the game. So for example, you could play Go. You know, Go is a game that scales. You know, the usual board is 19 by 19, but you could play on a k by k board. And now for each k, you could ask, does white have the winning strategy or does black have the winning strategy? You know, in principle, you can determine it. You know, you can show that there is a bound to the length of the game. It just gets longer and longer. And it's actually been shown that this problem is p-space complete, and that all these computations can be encoded into games of this type. And that you know, if you had the computer that could answer that type of question, you could do a lot. But that's more powerful than this. Okay, so even the multiverse cannot tell you if you can win at Go. In this limit of the board becoming arbitrarily big. Okay, so it's a weird result, but as I say, it's sort of philosophically or something fascinating, because you know, one had this idea that the multiverse could do anything, and now we find that in this precise sense it's not true, that the multiverse can do anything. Okay, but having said that, I'm happy to answer questions about that, because it is a striking result. PP easily covers min-BP. You know, there's no problem with solving min BP once you're in PP. But now here's the remainder of the argument. Of course, this is the general thing. This is where we just say, you know, I have a particular answer in mind. You know, if I get the answer, I live. If I don't, I die and I try again in some other direction of the multiverse. But that's not what presumably our multiverse is doing. We do not have the power, except by this personal choice, we certainly don't have the power to terminate the whole branch of the universe that we live on. Rather, there's a very specific selection that is going on, which we, you know, has been discussed, you know, very much. You know, which versions of this selection are the interesting ones, but it's definitely not, you know, to the extent that we are physicists and having this discussion, it's not a matter of personal choice. It's something that the universe did, and that is the post-selection, and it's not some broader class of things. So we cannot do an arbitrary computation. Our multiverse doesn't do an arbitrary computation in post-BQP. It does post-BQP. Ours is post, you know, BQP with a very specific post-selection on these, you know, some type of anthropic or, you know, empirical environmental consideration. And again, you can debate what you should put in, but it doesn't actually matter too much for the argument I'm about to give. Things like the value of the cosmological constant being 100 times bigger are clearly out. Things like the cosmological constant varies by a tiny fraction of a percent are almost certainly in. Yeah. It's an asymptotic statement as the size of the in the size of the game. Yeah, that's right. For a fixed size board, it's in one of these classes.
But for our particular cosmological constant that we observe, you're saying, or
okay. Well, let me say it because it's yeah, you're sort of anticipating, and I'll try to say it as best I can, and then you can. Yeah, that's right. So indeed, there was this kind of theoretical result that allows any type of post-selection, but it seems to me for cosmology we don't have such generality. Rather, we have a specific class of selection conditions that we believe are relevant to our problem. And they do include things like the cosmological constant that's within this range, and they do not include things like is the particular cosmological constant that we see the minimum out of the consistent possibilities. And you can easily construct toy models to that is a separate thing, which this post-selection is not going to help you to solve. You would just take your model that you like, V0, and you would add another landscape, V1, which has the same general type of structure, but it's all on a hidden sector, and it's all on the scale 10 to the minus 200 times what we see. Yeah, we don't know. Maybe such a thing can exist within string theory. And now, suppose you've found the minimum here. Well, you still got to find the minimum there. And if it's in the hidden sector and only affecting the cosmological constant on such a tiny scale, then it's very hard to argue that the choice here has anything to do with anthropic post-selection. Excuse me. And so you just lose all the power of this, and now you're back down to BQP. And as we argued, BQP cannot really solve that problem. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, two things. Yeah, I'm not going to make a.
Fine.
Yeah, go on.
You have some kind of a priori idea.
Right.
You can get some string theory of what a model.
Good.
Looks
right.
Like,
yes. Right? Yes.
But what you never seem to say is that you hope at the end of this to predict anything on the basis of this model.
Oh yes, I have implicitly said it. I implicitly said it here. Yeah. So this could be testing a very complicated logical proposition derived from looking at all the vacuum principle and saying, yes, we predict low-scale supersymmetry or high-scale supersymmetry. That is some complicated logical function of the data of the vacuum V. And now I'm discussing questions like, well, could we ever hope to make such a prediction, given such and such computational resources? And then I'm making this sort of slightly philosophical jump to say that, well, we can do it. There's some sense in which the universe is doing it. All right, so it is implicit in the discussion. Yeah. That's right. So there is this philosophical discussion that we should come back to. Yeah. Right. Well, we're all talking about things that are pretty fixed with time. The cosmological constant is varying very slowly. So what we're doing is we're trying to say, basically, can we falsify this class of models? Is it the case that no string theory vacuum could fit the data?
Okay, now that's
yeah. That's right. That's the class of question that I'm addressing.
So, the overview of quantum cosmology with the universe has some say.
Good.
Our job is to make a theory of it.
Right. Okay, well, okay, good.
But your theory might be.
Right. Okay. Yes. I have to put this in. You're right. Okay. Very good. I was hoping, of course, that you would make this objection that I have left out something essential, which is that we did not talk about the initial condition or the measure factor on initial conditions and anything. That's right. That's quite right. Okay. So indeed, everything back to some t equals epsilon is in BQ. What do we know about the wave function initial condition? And of course, the unfortunate answer is that after many years of work, we really don't know terribly much. And so we have to parameterize what we know about it. Okay, so how can we parameterize what we know about it? Well, again, it's simplest to think of this in the frameworks where there is some sort of idea of state at a given time. The wave function is giving us something. Another way to phrase it that doesn't talk about state is to think that the wave function is, in some sense, an oracle that the system calls once. Okay, so it's one of these black boxes. We're not giving it any input. We ask it, what is the wave function? And it tells us. Okay, so that is sitting there. We can call it once. Okay, so that is the precise thing. That's right. And so such things could, of course, in principle, you could postulate a psi that could solve this problem. Okay, so that's that. Now we've reduced it to this. Okay, now suppose we grant, for example, the Hartle-Hawking wave function, where you can draw a picture like this. Okay, where this is just, you know, no boundary. Okay, well now, not proven, but a very plausible possibility that indeed the physics that is constructing this wave function is comparable to the physics which is operating out here. It's the same kind of quantum mechanics. It should also have the power of a quantum computer with roughly the same number of states. And therefore, I would claim that that class of wave function, you know, some ill-defined class, but a class of interesting wave functions is also effectively computed by a computer in BQP. Right? And so that's the assumption I have to make. Indeed, I have to assume something about the initial condition, but if I assume that the wave function was computed by a quantum computer in this class, then this trivially just equals the BQP. And that's the assumption I needed here.
I'm trying to make it more general.
Yeah. Well, see, that's I'm again going on to say, well, let's just, we don't know the ultimate reality, but suppose we postulate some model for this state. Well, either the model will do a computation in BQP or it will do something else. And if the model does something in BQP, then you can apply this argument to it.
A second one. Right. The theory of computation, for example, we have
computable
and non-computable numbers.
Right.
The property being computable is a property of the number.
Right.
And not the way the number is represented.
Right.
So you have a particular representation of your theory of this EP.
Well, I'm conclusions over here more come from statements like this, not any details of BP.
Yeah, but
yeah.
There's nothing to prevent somebody from coming along and reconfigure this.
Oh, yeah, no, I quite agree. So we. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. That's right. So we could imagine a duality that just magically solves this problem, and we face a problem, not a class of ever increasing problems, and so this is always possible. And well, see, so I'm not making some sort of absolute statement. I am saying that suppose now, you know, you or somebody proposes, you know, a model of quantum gravity, a way to get the wave function. Well, then one can ask, well, does this model, as best I understand, sit in this class or does it sit in a bigger class? What I'm saying is that if you believe your model leads to this, then you are implicitly believing that your model sits in a bigger class than this. It sits in some quantum version of this DP class. And I could easily imagine writing down models where, no, so far as you could tell, you know, it just looks like quantum mechanics, quantum field theory. You know, based on the evidence, it looks like it is in BQP. So in particular, the types. So what are the types of models that lead to this, you know, the selection factor? Well, I mean, there's a one which seems to be generally agreed. Again, nothing I suppose is generally agreed in this subject, but a model that leads to this type of measure factor is the model of eternal and stochastic inflation, which is another long story, but the idea being that you know, different inflating regions, just as in usual inflation you can make a slow roll down, so too there's some quantum probability to jump back up, and then properties of inflation mean that you can actually think of that as like a classical probability. Things very quickly decohere, and so you get a sort of branching landscape and very complicated space-time geometry where you produce, you explore the landscape and you produce all these kinds of vacua. And now you can write an equation that characterizes that process. It's highly ambiguous, but all the existing forms of that equation, you can ask, you know, within our choice of time coordinate, how long does it take for that equation to find the stationary state from some random point? And it takes exponential time. And the simple argument, of course, is that what are you doing? You have to somehow tunnel through these barriers to find the minimum, and that takes exponential time. And so that seems to be a correct conclusion about that class of models, and indeed, it doesn't satisfy my postulate. It uses exponential time. So it's not that this is some sort of proof that this can't be produced. It's a statement about the class of models that can produce it. And so another class of model you might consider is to say, well, we don't, all this may be true in some sense, and maybe it's dual to some realization of the Hartle-Hawking wave function, as people were speculating at strings. Well, now we would be claiming that this model, where it's clear we can do this calculation, is equivalent in some complicated way to this model, which looks more conventional. In fact, we might even be bolder and say there's some gauge theory that we can write down, you know, that constructs this wave function, and you know, we just take it to its ground state and do whatever we want and produce this wave function. And I would at this point say, well, it may be, but it's going to take exponential time to construct this wave function. It cannot do it in polynomial time. Yeah. Sure. Right. Okay.
We, on the basis of present data,
right,
could only constrain those to be within some region. And the computability and lack of it depends a lot on what kind of error it should be.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So
definitely.
If you allow more,
that's right.
Things tend to become more computable.
Right, definitely. Clearly.
Okay.
Clearly. Right.
So, for example, I don't know what you expect observational results to depend on the size of K.
Well, the relevant parameter here is the volume of this shell, and it depends on features here. But definitely, as the volume of this shell gets, say, bigger than 2 to the k, it starts to become easy to show that there's a lattice point. And indeed, we might be in that regime. Again, it's not some sort of absolute statement. It's an interesting theoretical consideration. I mean, the one very general thing one can say about that is, of course, to the extent that the problem becomes easier at this point, you've sort of lost predictivity. You know, it was easy to find a vacuum, but it's clear that there's no unique vacuum satisfying that. It's precisely because there's non-uniqueness that the problem became easier. So the optimal case for the cosmological constant, you know, should we be depressed by this? Well, the simplest argument that says no is that, well, no, this is all stuff in hidden sectors, and the cosmological constant is just totally decorrelated from everything else we measure. You know, and so we actually don't really care whether the properties of the hidden sector that give rise to that vacua. And if there are a factor, you know, in excess of 2 to the k, you know, extra vacua, we'll show it exists, and we won't care that much about it. So I'm, again, not, you know, it's sort of an interesting circle of ideas. I'm not saying this, you know, even could make string theory hard to test, but what I just said also relies on assumptions. You know, it could be that the cosmological constant is heavily correlated. It could be that the key to the problem really is to find this minimum guy, and that the properties just jump wildly as you move all over the place, and if that were the problem, we might be in trouble. So it's an interesting collection of ideas that certainly haven't been brought into the subject, and I think complexity theory has reached a sophistication where it can talk about sort of, you know, sufficiently complicated calculations that even wild cosmological models aren't beyond the parameters of what they've thought about. So I'll stop there. BP is probably not in BQP, according to this. Indeed, we make that statement. Yes.
I'm tempted to ask a very big question.
Of course. Right. The show.
What are you trying to falsify?
String theory. String theory. Ultimately. Yes. Yes, string theory. The goal is to show that you can. Okay. Well, the old picture was that there would be, you know, maybe, you know, 10 vacua or a million vacua, and the paradigm is just that you try them all and you see if they fit the data, and if none do, you falsified it. And the main point I've been trying to make is that numbers like this are still compatible with that paradigm if you are very clever. And numbers like this are kind of borderline, and numbers like 10 to the 10,000 are not. Only in the broadest sense. I mean, so the cosmological constant problem and this discrete one. Oh yeah, I agree. That would be the magic solution to this problem. That's certainly worth looking for. I'm using, yeah, go for it. I mean, these are problems based on, you know, extrapolating some piece of the, you know, some toy model or some piece of the problem, and it doesn't prove the thing you said doesn't exist. Right. Oh, no. I didn't see what I said. No. See, it's consistent. See, the thing I said was more general. It wasn't saying that, you know, obviously, to the extent that what you say remains a possibility, it could be that there are, you know, 10 to the 6 minus 1 vacuum that we rule out, and then this 1, you know, we require Greg Moore to compute the cosmological constant, and maybe it will come out. And at that point, you know, you haven't falsified the theory. You have pinned down the remaining aspect of the problem. And so that's the level of which I'm working. You know, should we hope to do this? And this is all very preliminary comments about the nature of the problem from that point of view. You know, it doesn't rule out. Yeah. Well, that's another interesting question. That's right. That's a much harder one. That one definitely requires getting into this measure factor in depth. That's right. Well, by definition, but it's not. It just takes time. You know, we've only been working on it for 20 years. You know, I mean. Okay. Yeah. Well, I agree, and it's a good thing people are working on the analogs of the abacus and all the other tools we can think of to help solve the problem.
So make a comment about the restart of the lattice. So the approach you mentioned is related to the polychrome. You take a point in space and you draw a ball, and you want to know whether or not there's what's the nearest point of the ball, or to give a list. And people have made crypto systems based off of this. And
yes.
Obviously, they felt very confident that the problem was difficult.
Yes.
And some of them work, and some of them required a lot of tinkering with after. So it's a very subtle subject, even with the knapsack.
Yes, that's the closest vector problem, yes.
Shamir, there's a knapsack system which people were very proud of.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's one reason people work so hard on these things. That's right.
And
that's right.
And also, for summing over an annulus, there are formulas in number theory that give exact formulas for the number of points. If you count... So you're counting the characteristic function of the annulus and summing that over the lattice. If you sum a smooth function, the formulas are very clean, and you can compute those much faster. So I'm just wondering whether or not that's relevant.
It's all very relevant, and it has to do with kind of, you know, even if you grant the problem has this exponential nature, well, obviously, you know, dividing the exponent by a factor of 10 would be a huge progress, and they're all that kind of thing. Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of ways in which the structure is important.
Oh, you definitely. That's what we need to look for. That's right. Right.
Real numbers happen to be zeros of the Riemann zeta functions, then you're in a lot better shape than you used to.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, no, these are all very generic arguments. So it's that's right.
Generic isn't the right thing.
Yeah, I quite agree. I that certainly, I mean, but then when you look at specific models and specific arguments, you often find that despite your ingenuity, they fall into some generic class. And this has been the history of the computer science. You know, we've looked at it just for, you know, cultural purposes. And, you know, people, you know, think they can, you know, find an argument that's going to lead to this. And then they find, well, you know, even though the arguments are very intricate, they all have such and such a generic property that still can't reach it. And, I agree. You can't generalize these things. I'm just saying that this collection of ideas, I think, is a useful one to have in the back of one's mind. Yeah.
Take from this as a conclusion that it may all be solvable in the end, but it will require some kind of reformulation of the problem that really exploits in an essential way
the
problem.
Right.
So, and particularly, it should not work for an arbitrary toy model that would really use string theory.
Right, but of course, if you only—that's right. But if you only repeat that mantra, of course, string theory is too complicated, and you'll never. You know, you'll never get there. So the thing is to find that class of problems that exhibits that special thing. Yeah, that's right. And it's just all kind of meta discussion, you know. But again, I think this is a useful class of arguments to keep in mind.
But that's analogous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That could be. That's right. No, definitely it's a very reasonable hypothesis that whatever the structure to the vacuum is, it's highly symmetric, and we can exploit that once we understand it.
It could also be the other way. I mean, a lot of these MPR problems are very easy in most instances, except in horrible instances. So integers is easy because half of them are even.
Right. And that's right. And here you can be quantitative if you're just willing to relax the, you know, if you have more vacuum than you need by this type of factor, it starts to become easier. That's right.